This week, China's former president Jiang Zemin died.
Former Chinese President Jiang Zemin has died at the age of 96.
He's seen as one of the architects of China's transformation into a market economy.
According to state media, he died of leukemia and multiple organ failure.
Jiang came to power in the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square protests. And during his tenure, he presided over key milestones in modern Chinese history, like the return of Hong Kong to Chinese rule in 1997.
Now, Hong Kong people are to run Hong Kong. That is the promise, and that is the unshakable destiny.
China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2001.
By adding China to the WTO, we strengthen the organization by further integrating China's 1.2 billion people and $1 trillion economy into the world market network.
And winning the bid to host the 2008 Summer Olympics.
I now have the honor of asking the President of the People's Republic of China to open the games of the 29th Olympiad of the modern era.
During Jiang's rule, China moved from an isolated poor country into a global economic superpower.
China was a more open and liberal place when he was there. He presided over a period of tremendous economic change and social tumult. And in that, there was a great push by Chinese society for a more open and pluralistic political system. Jiang helped lead China's integration into the global economy. And so that economic behemoth that we now think that China is really was a creation of that era.
Welcome to The Journal, our show about money, business, and power. I'm Kate Linebaugh. It's Friday, December 2nd. Coming up on the show, the legacy of China's Jiang Zemin.
This episode is brought to you by Vonage. With Vonage Video API, your developers can easily create custom video experiences tailored to your business. Enhance every conversation with live video, whether it's delivering faster tech support, improving customer service, or enabling interactive meetings and events. Unlock the true video potential of your business. Discover how at Vonage.com.
Our colleague Charles Hutzler covered China for more than 20 years. He started out as a correspondent there when Jiang Zemin was in power in the 90s. And the country was on the cusp of some big changes.
It seemed to be a great shift, though it was very hard to articulate what was going to happen. And when I went out there in 1995, it had just exploded in growth and change.
What do you remember about Jiang Zemin as a figure in Chinese life at that time?
Unlike most Communist Party officials, Jiang gave off this vibe as kind of a retail politician, and he kind of liked to joke around with the reporters. He spoke very stilted English, self-taught. He used to like to recite parts of the Gettysburg Address.
4 score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal.
And with reporters, he would walk over to us and sort of ask how we were and engage in small talk. His successors, Hu Jintao and now Xi Jinping, never did anything like that. They were remote, highly programmed figures in public.
Many remember Jiang for his thick square glasses, and also for his animated personality. He was known for being playful at times, and Charles says Jiang used it as a diplomatic tool, especially as he worked to grow China's influence in the West.
He liked to work a room and he loved music. So he liked to sing. And when foreign leaders would come to China, he would occasionally sing or dance. When he visited Buckingham Palace, he tried to sing and engage then Queen Elizabeth in song. And occasionally it went over, and at other times the visiting governments or the receiving governments felt it was a little much. So he had a boisterous personality, and it often showed through.
Like on a trip to the Philippines, where he sang along to Elvis's Love Me Tender.
He could also be petulant. He was not above reproaching reporters. And there's a very famous video clip that circulates sort of in meme form where he's chiding the Hong Kong press for asking him a question that he didn't like. And he calls them too simple, too naive.
Too simple. Sometimes naive.
Zhang joined the Communist Party when he was in college and rose through the ranks, serving as Shanghai's mayor at one point. In 1989, he was given the party's top job, general secretary. But the China he inherited didn't look like the China of today.
The economy did not have a competitive manufacturing sector. It was still a majority agricultural society. The manufacturing and processing base that makes things now like Apple iPhones or Nike shoes didn't exist at all. And incomes were paltry, both in the countryside and in the cities, and services were almost non-existent.
Before Jiang took over, there had been efforts to modernize the economy, but they had stalled. His government sought to reignite those efforts. One controversial step: open up China to the Western world.
They welcomed in foreign capital, and that helped seed this very low-level manufacturing, processing, and assembly base that relied on cheap labor. And labor poured in, not just from the cities, but also from the countryside. They tried to create a competitive export sector that would then fund the rest of the modernizing of the state economy.
But modernizing the state economy in some ways meant dismantling it. Under Jiang, China began to move away from an economy run only by the government and into one that had more private businesses.
Privatizing was always a dirty word in the Communist Party, but that's in effect what they did. They had a policy to reform the state industrial sector called hold on to the big and let go of the small. And so they maintained control over the big industries that they thought were strategic and critical. So energy, telecommunications, mining, and then all of the manufacturing industries, textiles, consumer goods, were sold off to private business people. And of all of the reforms, that economic reforms that were mounted under Jiang, the most important of all was the creation of a private housing sector. That is the cornerstone of individual and household wealth in China right now. Most Chinese own their own homes and apartments, and in many cases own more than one.
Another monumental decision he made was bringing China into the WTO.
WTO accession in 2001 was a landmark event for China. Foreign investment had already been pouring in, but it took off exponentially after 2001. China now had assured access to global markets, and it turned China into the manufacturing base for the world.
Why was it important for China to have good relationships with the U.S. and the West? And what was Zhang's role in that?
So in trying to court foreign investment, and particularly Western investment, keeping relations with the United States on an even keel was crucial. The U.S. was the biggest market for China, and the U.S. presided over the rules-based global order in which Jiang hoped that China could thrive. And so much of this effort to get into the World Trade Organization and to integrate China into the global economy was made easier with U.S. endorsement.
Back at home, it was Jiang's endorsement that paved the way for these reforms.
Dismantling the state sector, China's entry to the World Trade Organization, these were all very controversial reforms within China, and Jiang Zemin provided key political cover so that these reforms could be implemented.
And how would you characterize the end result of his economic achievements for China?
Well, China was night and day a different place from the time that he came to power and when he slowly began exiting the political stage in 2002, 2003. The economy had doubled. Standards of living had risen. Chinese cities, which had essentially been low-rise, started to become dotted by skyscrapers, Shanghai most famously.
Jiang's economic approach deviated from his predecessors, and it paid off. But when it came to social issues and political dissent, like previous leaders, Jiang ruled with an iron fist. That's after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. If you're like most people, you've had your fair share of financial questions. Questions like, will you be able to afford a third kid? Will you be able to do everything you want when you retire? What if you outlive your savings? Empower knows these questions can be stressful, so they're here to help answer your what-ifs and empower what's next. Join 18 million Americans and take control of your financial future. Tap the banner to learn more or visit empower.com.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/journal. Terms and conditions apply.
Jiang Zemin came to power right after the Tiananmen Square massacre, when China's military opened fire on demonstrators, killing hundreds of people. Why was Jiang chosen to lead China at this important moment?
He had been head of Shanghai at that time. He had held various other government positions before then. And in Shanghai, demonstrations also took place, but they were diffused peacefully. So one reason for his elevation was that he had handled this bad situation better. It was also seen by Communist Party elders that Jiang could be trusted. He wasn't going to push an agenda that they didn't agree with.
Calls for democracy like the ones at Tiananmen Square continued into Jiang's tenure. There were even attempts to form new political parties to rival the communist regime. And Jiang was quick to detain and jail activists.
So for all of his kind of, you know, his more liberal temperament, for his guiding China towards market-oriented reforms, he was uncompromising on challenges to the Communist Party. Now, that is true to the institution in which he came up, and Jiang Zemin never really wavered from that. His slogan was stability above all else, and that meant the hard fist of the Chinese security services and law enforcement coming down.
Charles says Jiang's more liberal economic policies were a double-edged sword. On one hand, they boosted the economy, but they also opened up China's society, which became a problem for the Communist Party.
As China's economy developed, its society also became more pluralistic. The Communist Party, which in the 1980s still controlled major facets of people's lives, began to retreat. And probably the biggest change of all is that people claimed the right to have their own private lives and not always be under the watchful eye of the Communist Party.
In the 90s, religious groups took off in China in a way that hadn't been tolerated before. Groups like the Falun Gong spiritual movement. And Jiang eventually oversaw a brutal crackdown on them.
They had been experiencing some minor government repression and decided to stage a protest in the heart of Beijing. And they managed to surround the Communist Party leadership compound of Zhongnanhai, which was an unheard of event. And that precipitated one of the broadest crackdowns on any group that the Communist Party had conducted in many, many decades.
Thousands have been detained since China's communist government began last week's crackdown. This week, Falun Gong literature was confiscated and very publicly destroyed.
Falun Gong believers were subjected to a broad and brutal suppression campaign with tens of thousands put through really rigorous deprogramming regimes in which some people died. And that would not have happened without Jiang Zemin demanding it so.
In a letter to party officials, Jiang said Falun Gong was a threat to the Communist Party's authority and the movement challenged China's stability. Jiang stepped down as party chief in 2002 and as president a year later. But Charles says he continued to have sway over Chinese politics from behind the scenes. Like in 2012, when China's current leader, Xi Jinping, was named head of the Communist Party.
Jiang Zemin was able to appeal to various interest groups within the Communist Party, and he backed Xi Jinping, partly because Xi Jinping had this very solid Communist Party pedigree. She is the son of one of these first-generation Communist Party revolutionaries and was seen to be a trusted figure for leading China.
But in recent years, Jiang's political influence waned.
He had really faded from the public eye for a long time, except for these occasional appearances at big party meetings. Months, years could go by without Jiang Zemin's name or images being reported by state media.
On social media, Chinese citizens have shared mixed recollections of Jiang. Some lament the passing of a charismatic leader, and others recall an authoritarian who suppressed challenges to China's Communist Party. What would you say Jiang Zemin's legacy is, and is it still visible in China today?
I think Jiang Zemin's legacy is having presided over a lot of key moments marking China's rise to a more powerful country. And, you know, it would be a stretch to call Jiang a liberal in a classic Western sense. But there seemed to be room for change and for possibility. And again, his tactile feel for politics contributed to that. He had to march China out of the diplomatic isolation that it was in because of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. And he became an active figure in global fora. And China was not welcome in many global gatherings in the immediate aftermath of the Tiananmen crackdown. And so he had to use a lot of charm to put China back on the global stage.
That's all for today, Friday, December 2nd. The Journal is a co-production of Gimlet and The Wall Street Journal. Your hosts are Ryan Knutson and me, Kate Linebaugh. The show's produced by Melvis Acosta Crisostomo Annie Baxter, Catherine Brewer, Maria Byrne, Pia Gadkari, Rachel Humphreys, Matt Kwong, Annie Minoff, Laura Morris, Afif Nasuli, Enrique Perez de la Rosa, Sarah Platt, Aaron Randall, Alan Rodriguez Espinosa, Vladislav Sedik, Pierce Singhi, Jivika Verma, Lisa Wang, and Catherine Whalen, with help from Jonathan Sanders. Our engineers are Griffin Tanner, Nathan Singapak, and Peter Leonard. Our theme music is by So Wiley. Additional music this week from Catherine Anderson, Peter Leonard, Bobby Lord, Emma Munger, and Blue Dot Sessions. Fact-checking by Nicole Pasulka. Thanks for listening. See you Monday.